You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, where we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines around our region this past week. Joining me live in studio today, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Mike Sharp with KIVI Television, and Don Day with Boise Dev. Welcome, everybody.
Hi, thanks Gemma. For having us.
All right, so a lot going on. Melissa, let's just start with Medicaid expansion and the updates with what happened in the State House.
Right, a number of things happened over the last few weeks. So last Monday, of course, we saw the very first sideboard bill from Senator Mary Souza that did a number of things. But I think most significantly, it put an automatic repeal onto Medicaid if the federal match changed from the current 90-10 that Idaho based it, all of its projections off of. That bill likely isn't going anywhere. It hasn't been scheduled for a hearing, and we're hearing it's kind of DOA. This week at a breakfast with the Idaho Press Corps, Governor Brad Little made it very clear he will not let the legislature go home without funding Medicaid expansion, because this has been kind of a hovering question mm-hmm. since the election, right? There's a statute on the books, but that doesn't mean the legislature has to fund it. It was likely going to be not likely, right? But it was still a possibility, and that's something that the Senate Assistant Majority Leader told us on Idaho Reports a couple weeks ago, that that's still on the table for lawmakers if they're not happy with sideboards that are or are not passed. But the governor made it very, very clear that is not acceptable to him. But he didn't go far... Or he didn't go so far as to say which sideboards that are currently being discussed he would or would not support. He said that there are some that he doesn't favor, but wouldn't say if he would veto them or wouldn't even say which ones he didn't like. Meanwhile, on Thursday in the House Health and Welfare Committee, Republican Representative John Green and Julianne Young proposed legislation that would repeal Medicaid expansion, arguing that voters weren't well enough informed when 61% of them approved Proposition 2 in November. That failed to get even printed. So that isn't going anywhere. It was funny, the argument that voters weren't well informed, because these, of course, are the same voters who sent these very representatives to the
office.
State House. Side note, that's fine. meanwhile,
FYI.
Yeah, just not for nothing. I think the real proposals, the ones that are going to take a lot of discussion and will likely end up in front of the governor eventually, are floating around among House Health and Welfare members. I'm hearing that Representative John Vanderwoude has been juggling 13 different proposals. Some of them are, ranging from work requirements to voluntary work training to what he told me is his personal favorite, is an enrollment period. So much like we have on the state exchange right now, where you can't just sign up anytime, there would be a specific set of time that would be the same as the state exchange, where people could sign up for Medicaid if they are eligible, barring life-changing events like, getting let go from your job mm-hmm. or getting married or having a child, that sort of thing. No word yet on when those will be introduced in a print hearing. We thought it would be this week. They clearly haven't come up. But it's going to when they hit, I imagine a lot of them will hit all around the same mm-hmm. time, because some of them are mutually exclusive. And I think lawmakers want to get the full picture of what's possible before signing up for one and mm-hmm. Potentially ignoring another one.
But bottom line is they have to get this done.
Well,
they've been tasked by the governor to get it done.
Right. By get it done, we're talking funded.
Right.
That's the only thing the governor has said is you have to fund this. And remember, that's the only thing the legislature is constitutionally required to do, is fund state government and then go home. They don't have to pass sideboards, but leadership has made it very clear that they want something, regardless of what that might be. Or how far that might go, they want something, as does the majority of the Republican caucus.
Mike, I want to talk about a bill that was passed into law. I cannot say the word properly, so I'm going to hand over.
Naloxone.
So what is that? And talk to me about this bill.
So we've been following at Six on Your Side
the opioid epidemic mm-hmm. over the last year. We've talked to a lot of stakeholders, the people who are trying to stem off this disastrous thing that's hitting our communities. And one of the things that pretty much everybody who is a stakeholder has said helps and saves lives is naloxone. It's a medication that's applied nasally that pretty much brings somebody from an overdose back to life. It's pretty sudden and it's fast acting. It's a remarkable thing. Mm-hmm. But there has been confusion. This law that passed is one of those interesting the original law, I think it was 2015 when it hit the books, had some wording in it that concerned certain individuals about whether or not they could prescribe naloxone to individuals who may be able to administer it and save those lives. So this is clarifying that law in a lot of jumbled words, right? It's clarifying that law to make it so that people feel more comfortable in prescribing and then administering this drug that could save lives. And, you know, I've had a couple conversations with people who are inside the state house, working in the governor's office, working as legislators. This is just the first thing. And it's not really the first. It's one of many steps in the process to make this drug more accessible to individuals, to have, you know, people who are working in public buildings have the access to help save these lives. If somebody comes in and they're dozing off and they're falling to sleep, you know, as it seems in a dangerous way, it helps to have somebody able to open a drawer and administer this drug quickly and then call 911. And then the paramedics can show up and make sure that this person is stable. So it's literally, I mean, it's saving lives and it's cutting down on the amount of time between as you're soaking into that overdose mm-hmm. and getting the help from an EMT. It enables you to kind of stabilize during that time.
And Melissa?
You know, it's interesting, as we've been looking at the opioid crisis statewide at Idaho Reports, naloxone has made a huge difference. Melinda Smizer, the administrator at the Office on Drug Policy, said that last year naloxone availability was directly linked to saving 36 lives. So there are some other factors in the distribution of naloxone from the Office on Drug Policy as far as the data. In the 7 public health districts in the state, they like to look at where the different parts of the state are seeing the most opioid overdoses mm-hmm. or arrests, that sort of thing. But some of that data is missing or incomplete. Of the 241 overdose deaths in 2017, 42 of those deaths, we don't know what drug caused that death. And part of the reason for that is coroners aren't required to do tox screens in the state. We have 44 counties, and those 44 coroners all do things a little bit differently. So some of them do tox screens on every single overdose death, and some of them just don't, partly because of budgetary reasons. Also, a lot of this information is siloed. So the law enforcement doesn't always interface with the public health districts. That doesn't always interface with child welfare services, where kids are being taken away because mm-hmm. of substance abuse issues in the home. And so we don't yet, as a state, have the full picture for where these naloxone kits might be most effective.
Right. And you mentioned Melinda Smizer, and I think that's something to note, you know, being the first year of Governor Little's administration. Melinda Smizer is somebody who could very easily be governor herself, right? She's a former state senator. She ran Senator Risch's office here in Idaho. She took this job running their Office of Drug Policy because she knows that this is one of the most important issues that Governor Little is going to be tackling mm-hmm. in his administration, and she's going to play a major role in that. So this is something to watch if you're looking for issues that are going to become bigger and bigger deals over the years that Governor Little is governor.
Absolutely. And I think when I talked to her last week, a big focus of hers is on education in the schools. People in the community that I've spoken to, drug rehabilitation professionals, are very concerned about the rehab and recovery portion of it, because we focused a lot of resources on things like what's happening in the crisis at the moment. But long-term recovery is a years or sometimes lifelong mm-hmm. struggle. And there are resources that these folks are saying they need in the communities outside of Boise and Coeur d'Alene and the other population centers. You know, if you go to Cottonwood, if you go to Orofino, people in those communities are really struggling with the lack of resources for long-term recovery.
I want to switch gears now and bring Dawn into the conversation because, okay, Dawn, explain to us what happened this week at a Boise City Council meeting regarding the stadium, but also being able to vote on odd years versus even years.
Yeah, so we'll go from complicated things at the State House
to more complicated things
a few blocks away at City Hall.
Yeah.
So the City Council had set a meeting on Tuesday to discuss the library and the stadium projects going forward. And I'm going to kind of go at it out of chronological order here a little bit. As the discussion went along, it was clear that the five City Council members who were in attendance wanted to consider putting up an advisory vote on the stadium. Not so much on the library project because they think that's core to the city function, but on the stadium. Before they got to that discussion, however, the mayor started with a preamble that essentially said, you know, we might not actually be able to do an advisory vote. We've been doing some checking with the county, and these can maybe only happen in even-numbered years. And we're in an odd-numbered year, right? 2019,
right.
First grade math here. And so that actually seemed to take city councilors by surprise. They, I think, were primed to call for an advisory vote on the stadium. This happens against a backdrop of two citizen initiatives to put both the library and the stadium to public votes. The mayor made a point that, well, they're really not related except for they're both in the city limits. They are, of course, related in the fact that they're both big projects that mm-hmm. can use tax dollars to get built. But the point is there. They are different projects. I did some checking and was a little surprised when I talked to the county clerk the next day, Phil McGrain. He said, it caught me by surprise this morning. I didn't expect to be in the news at all. And as we talked, he actually hadn't been contacted by the mayor's office. The mayor had made a statement that they had been talking to the clerk, and McGrain said no, and it wasn't anybody in our office. I went back to the mayor's office, and they said, you know what, that was actually a mistake on the part of the chief of staff. He had assumed that legal had had this discussion. McGrain, when I talked to him on Wednesday, kind of said, the mayor might be right. We might not be able to have such an advisory vote, but we're not sure. It requires more investigation. A smart Boise Dev reader pointed me to a Secretary of State manual that actually does make it seem like these votes can be happening in odd-numbered years. But that's all still to be sorted out. It's my sense that City Council is going to have more discussion on this in coming weeks. In fact, they're going to take some more public input on the cabin this Tuesday mm-hmm. at City Hall. So this is one of those stories that just it seems simple, and then the deeper into it you get, the more and more complicated it is. Lots of opinions and lots of big pieces that are trying to come together here as these big civic works projects try and come mm-hmm. To fruition.
And quickly, for people that may not know, what is an advisory vote?
So an advisory vote would be a non-binding vote that would allow the citizens of Boise to go to the polls and say, yes, I want to use tax money for a stadium, or no, I do not. It's different from the initiative process, which would be in, would in theory be binding. And McGrain said, you know, citizens can initiate laws. So if the citizen initiative process said there will not be tax dollars put towards a stadium, that in theory would be binding. Now, the city believes that that's not constitutional. I think that's all going to be sorted out in coming months. But the initiative folks have been very clear to me that regardless of whether there's an advisory vote held on the stadium or not, they still plan to move forward to gather signatures and put it up to a vote on both the stadium and the library. So I think you're going to see a very interesting 6 months or so play out, both with these potential advisory votes, initiative votes, and then, of course, the city elections for the mayor and two council seats this November.
Which I think is a really important note, that all while this is happening,
right.
the mayor is also going to be on the ballot. And if you're bringing out more and more voters and people who are concerned about these issues, it puts a lot of stuff in flux. This is going to be a really interesting election.
It does. And I look at it through the lens of I think people are really interested in growth and how they can have an impact on growth. And I think I've said that on this show before, that the municipal elections are really the biggest lever they can pull.
Mm-hmm.
I did a long interview with Governor Little last week on growth. And it's interesting because that was not a big topic during the election for the gubernatorial race in either the primary or the general, because there's so many other issues. Some of the things that Melissa and Mike just talked about. But growth is what's on the minds of voters in Boise. And
right.
the biggest lever they have to pull are the municipal elections this
year. Who's in charge of the city?
Yep.
Right. We're continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My guests in studio, Don Day with Boise Dev, Mike Sharp with KIVI Television, and Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television. So, Don, we left off talking about the stadium, but now I want to talk about the library, because the city of Boise brought this up in the meeting as well. And this is really around the cost, correct?
Yeah. So this comes out less out of the meeting and out of reporting that I've been working on for a while. The The library project, the city's been pretty clear, will stick to an $80 to $85 million budget figure. But the latest estimates for all-in costs are over $100 million, and actually $104 million. So you're looking at as much as a 30% increase over what they're hoping to spend. And they're going through a pretty major process to figure out how they're going to get there. And we're not talking about little things. They've already dropped the idea to put a theater in the project, at least in the first phase. It could happen later. They're now discussing taking the arts and history piece out and phasing that and having it be later. They're talking about shrinking the entire project by about 10% in floor size to get the costs in line. And then lots of little things like, do we do a terrazzo floor or just polished concrete? Do we do brick pavers? They're really trying to figure out how do they get this vision that a national architect has put forth into the budget that they have. And it's a pretty massive project. The story's up on BoiseDev.com right now. You can look at it. It's 1,200 words just to kind of explain what's going on here and how they're trying to do this and what's going to happen coming in the next few months.
With that, you know, what's interesting is that it seems that a lot of the pushback on this has been the cost. So if they can bring that cost down, do you have any idea what – would this be more palatable, I guess?
I tend to – I mean, it's hard to say.
Right.
I read a lot of the feedback on my site and other places, and I think that people are mostly seeing sticker shock. I don't know that folks say a library isn't necessary, although you get some of those. It's interesting because in the city council meeting you referenced on Tuesday, several of the city councilors said, you know, this is a $15 million investment. Well, it is, but it really isn't, because they're using a couple of other buckets of money from the Capital City Development Corporation, which are tax dollars, and then a lease financing arrangement that would also allow the CCDC to help pay for this project. And some folks look at tax increment financing and urban renewal as a great tool, and it does a lot. But they also worry about the implications for the taxpayers throughout the city. If those dollars are going towards stadiums or libraries, but the police service needs more money, that's going to come from the existing tax base that's not in the urban renewal district. So it definitely makes people just go, boy, what makes sense? Where should we be spending our dollars, and how should we be doing this? And the all-in dollar figure for public money is like $62 million. They do hope to raise a big portion of that from private funders, and they say they're ahead of schedule on that. But $62 million for anything.
That's not a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
Melissa, we talked about this on the program already, but the maternal morbidity review panel that Idaho does not have, talk to us about that, because we're one of, I believe, only seven states that does not have one of these panels.
And one of only two states without a plan in place. And this is something we actually talked about through my healthcare fellowship. Through the Association of Healthcare Journalists, we went to the CDC and specifically talked about maternal morbidity. And so this is a story I've been keeping an eye on for a while, even before this legislation was before the legislature. Idaho has a higher death rate for women who are pregnant or who have recently given birth, higher than the United States.
Average.
And of course, the United States has a much higher rate than the rest of the developed world and even some developing countries. And so it's an issue, interestingly enough, that barely passed the House this week. One vote. Yes. And some of the people who had supported it in committee changed their minds, partly because of cost and partly because of concerns about privacy and how the data might be used. But it's interesting because one of the arguments that was made was it's a relatively low number of deaths. Well, not when you're looking at the rate. It's 27 deaths per 100,000 live births. And Idaho does keep track. And this is an important distinction. Idaho does keep track of women's pregnancy status when they die, whether they are currently pregnant when they die or if they have given birth in the last year. This panel would try to figure out if there are any links between those deaths, whether it's poor health care, other issues.
You know what's fascinating to me about this, Melissa, is the idea that people within the state house would say, well, it's a low number of deaths. But there is a ripple effect when a mother dies.
Absolutely. It affects the family. It affects the whole community in some case. I mean, it's a horrific thing. And, you know, so like I said, the department does keep track of the pregnancy mm-hmm. status of these deaths. 121 women who were pregnant or recently pregnant died between 2008 and 2017. And they were able to determine the cause of most of those deaths. Mm-hmm. There are racial disparities in those deaths, too. Disproportionately affects women of color, especially American Indian and Hispanic women, as well as non-Hispanic Black women. They die at much higher rates, even though it's a relatively low number. But as they told us at the CDC, one death is too many. Mm-hmm. One preventable death is too mm-hmm. many. And the causes are, you know, 34 of them are for accidents, and that's something that can affect anybody, regardless of pregnancy status. But some of them, you know, are
some
medical
related.
Some of
them are preventable.
Right. That's where the maternal morbidity review panel would mm-hmm. come in.
Well, and these are important numbers because you talk about the rate of deaths among the babies as well as the mothers. It speaks to so much more. I mean, you mentioned the effects, but it speaks to the level of healthcare in
right.
our state. It speaks to economy in our mm-hmm. state. It speaks to the treatment of different races, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are so many issues that are all within this one number that you can really unpack within it. But you can't follow that number and really understand it unless you're evaluating that number and really looking into each detail.
I think it also speaks to the value we place on families. We mm-hmm. say that we are a family-friendly state, but if we have mothers who are dying of preventable causes...
Well, the value we place on mothers.
The value we place on women, the value mm-hmm. we place on women as a whole, right? The value we place on those children, too. I think it's notable, too, that looping back around to our opioid conversation... 10 were from drug overdoses, 10 of those deaths in that time, mm-hmm. and 7 were from homicide.
So where does this go next, Melissa, since it barely passed?
It bounces to the Senate, and it's something that we'll continue to track as it gets debated in the Senate Health and Welfare Committee.
And we should note that in the state of California, I think it's important to note that their state officials years back noticed this as well, and they put a review panel in place, and their maternal morbidity rate has dropped below the national average. So there are statistics that show that this makes a difference.
I think it's also notable, too, when it comes to the cost, that this committee would cost $27,000 over the course of 4 years, paid for with a federal grant.
$27,000?
That's a rounding error when we're talking about a health and welfare budget that is... significantly more than that. We're talking mm-hmm. billions of dollars, most of it from federal money. I'll just put that out there.
I appreciate that you did. And we are out of time. I want to thank all of you for coming in. I know we didn't get to a lot of stuff, but I think important information. My guest today, Don Day with Boise Dev, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, and Mike Sharp with KIVI Television. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate the conversation.
Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks.